Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We're in Ottawa, Ontario, where allegedly it's spring. I was freezing walking over here today in the rain. It was not a particularly pleasant day to come to the University of Ottawa, but I'm thrilled I came because there is a show going on starting Thursday night, May the 1st, is the preview night, opening night, Friday night, May the 2nd. It's called Corpus. It's being put on by the Counterpoint Players, and we have with us the director, Bronwyn Steinberg, and one of the lead actors, Daniel Sadovoy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm so excited that you're here because this show sounds really cool and really exciting. So before we really get into the depth of it, let's talk about just broadly, what is the show about?
Okay, well, Corpus is written by an Ottawa playwright, Dara Tytle. She moved to Ottawa a couple years ago. She's not from Ottawa originally. And the story is about a young woman who's a scholar. She's working on her PhD, and she studies genocide. And she's looking for that thing, that central case study that will really make her thesis. And then she meets this young man who lives in Berlin, Heinrich, who's played by Daniel here. They meet online, which is kind of exciting because the play takes place in 2004. So
yeah, it's a period piece.
And she's really on the cutting edge with her technology that she can actually interview and meet people, you know, using webcams.
Yeah, webcams were a big deal then.
Yeah. Big deal. Yeah, you had to plug it in.
Oh, yeah.
It's
a whole business.
Yeah. Anyway, so they meet and they start talking on webcams, and it turns out he has a story that might be of interest for her. Can I take over there?
Yes, he has a story. His grandmother actually was the wife of a prominent SS guard in Auschwitz, and so he has an inside scoop onto a very interesting and titillating story that she picks up on. And so the play is sort of it's a bit of a memory play where you see the relationship between her and Heinrich progressing as she's learning about this story, and then you watch the story itself progress. Back in the 40s at the same time.
Yeah, so it's like, they're like flashback scenes, but in fact,
It's actually two threads
two
that are
stories,
woven together.
Yeah, that are woven together, and so it alternates a little bit between the 1944 and 2004 timelines.
Yeah. So it's not really a play about the Holocaust so much as it's a play that discusses the Holocaust.
That's right. I mean, it uses historical material, certainly, from the Holocaust, but it's not a true story. It's not trying to teach anyone about this is what it was like in Auschwitz. In fact, the scenes that we see there are much more about the interaction between the two characters, which could happen anywhere, given similar circumstances.
Yeah, given a similar power
it's just
dynamic.
the backdrop of it. But what's interesting from a historical perspective is, to me, this play is about how we look at history and how, when we look at history, we're looking at ourselves. When we look at a period in history like that, there's often a tendency to get really, dare I say, obsessed with finding out what happened and figuring it out. And I know personally, I went through a period where I was very interested in Holocaust fiction and then nonfiction as well, because I just couldn't grasp it. I couldn't understand it. And I felt like I needed to know. Mm-hmm. I needed to get it. And I've talked to Dara, the playwright, about this, and she also went through a similar stage in her life. This is now 20 years ago for each of us when we were just first learning about this. But it's that impulse, I think, if I can speak for Dara, that is part of what led her to her writing the play, and it's also part of what's going on for Megan, the character, is that desire to make sense of these dark things and try to figure out how could this have happened and what does it mean and how do I relate to it. So, yes, we're looking at this thing in history, but we're also looking at ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because eventually, why are you so interested is the question that...
Yeah.
When I was telling someone I was going to actually travel to Poland and see Auschwitz, she said, "Why would you do that? Why do you feel like you have to see it?" And I said, "I just do. I need to bear witness. And I can't do this play about it without having been there, though you certainly could do the play without having been there. I felt it was important. But I still don't really know why and what that impulse is about." And I think the play is examining that.
Yeah. I mean, there's something that happens when you see something very, very dark that you're connected to, and it sort of haunts you, and one of the ways that you can try to exorcise those things to get them out of you is to, you know, is to intellectualize it and to study it. And I think that's what a lot of Holocaust or genocide scholars in general have ended up doing, is there's this inexplicable injustice that happens and you can't explain why humans would act this way. And it's very dark, and it might keep you up at night. And so what you do is you study it, and you delve into it, and you categorize behaviors, and you catalog thought processes, and it can sort of help you think that you're trying to make sense of something terrible that happened. But I think what's very interesting about this play is that it kind of takes that idea and just, you know, explodes it all over the place and deconstructs the deconstruction, if that's not too heady and annoying. Yeah.
But in addressing this sort of obsession, to use the word that you used, how much of that is going to be motivated by your personal connection to the story? Because someone like me, I have no direct path to the Holocaust.
No.
Whereas, you know, Dara, I'm assuming probably does in some way, as a Jewish playwright, and I'm assuming at some point you could probably trace something back to the Holocaust. And yet someone like me, I don't have that connection, therefore I don't have this obsession to really know about the Holocaust. Whereas I've read a lot about slavery and the civil rights movement, and that sort of stuff is more appealing to me because for me there's more of a personal connection, because middle class white guys were the ones who were doing these terrible things in that context. And I'm trying to understand, because I'm a middle class white guy, sort of understand their point of view and then how all these things play out. So that's where my connection comes to, maybe not something like this. So are people's personal experiences going to be mitigated, or their connection to the story going to be mitigated by their personal experiences?
I would argue that's always the case with looking at history, but also just looking at art. You know, you'll see any play, any piece of fiction, any painting, and you have your different relationship to it. But there's that saying that the universal is in the details. You can't make a play about a concept that just says, oh, we like to look at dark things. Then what do you do? You have to give it some kind of context. And once you really start to make details and stories in that context, whether it's the Holocaust or the civil rights movement or whatever it is, I think that anyone and everyone ends up being able to relate to it, because those universal themes are still in there. Mm. It's just being told from a particular perspective. But I wouldn't say that that perspective is alienating if you don't have a relationship to it. Or
no.
Not that you said that, but I don't think that it's... I don't think there's any reason you can't get in there.
Mm.
I know that I was talking to someone who had just read The Book of Negroes, and she, you know... white, whatever, middle class, and she's like, I feel like I'm black now, having read it. You know, it just, it affected her so profoundly, even though it's a completely different experience, because, for one, it's written well, but again, the universal is in the details. There's universal themes and experiences that are just human.
Yeah. And about getting in, you know, your personal experiences, mitigating it, one of the things that happens in this play is one of the characters says to the other ones, you know, you weren't there. So you might have a line in on, like, the academic pursuit of something, and you said that you might feel more connected to something like civil rights or slavery. But, again, you weren't, you know, a part of the civil rights movement or slavery directly.
Right.
And you might not be descended from slaves, and you may or may not be descended from slave owners, but you still feel a personal connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what the play addresses, is feeling a personal connection to something that you may or may not have really been a part of, and trying to use academia to try to... Mm-hmm. get in. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it's something that we've talked about on the show before, where in history we can get desensitized to things. And we talk about the wars and we say 100,000 people died, and that number becomes meaningless.
Completely.
Until you get into personal stories, and it's that one person, you find out about the one person, and then the humanity in the war is reclaimed. And it's no longer just numbers and stats.
And it's overwhelming a bit, isn't it? I mean, when you find that one personal story and then you try to multiply that by 100,000, you cannot. So, I mean, it makes me ask, what is the point of doing either of these things? They're so divergent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I think that's the role of the artist, is to find those stories. And whether they're true or not doesn't even really matter. David Dean, who's a historian at Carleton, talks about authenticity versus accuracy when he's talking about historical plays or fiction or anything, that when there's an authentic human story, whether the actual details of someone having had that experience in history are quite accurate or not, it's a way in. It's a lens that we can use to look at this time and understand it, especially when the numbers and the stats and the dates that you look at as a historian aren't necessarily able to give the full picture or to give that human picture.
Mm-hmm. You used a word that I think is really interesting. You said it's true. Now, how much of this, as of this story, then, is true, quote unquote?
Oh, just the framework of the story is true, and I believe a playwright found, you know, I'm not sure if this is accurate, but I believe she found either a document discussing the possibility of a certain romantic relationship, or she was in the presence of people who were talking about, you know, just a hypothetical thing. So, in terms of the details of a perpetrator and victim romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much that's based on fact, but my impression was that it was not at all. Yeah.
And I would say, on the one hand, all of it's true and none of it is true, because true is such an ambiguous word.
Yeah.
It's all, again, to use this word that I don't know if it makes any sense, but authentic to what could be a true human experience.
Right.
And yet none of it's historically accurate. These characters have invented
names.
Some
of the dates and the events.
Yeah.
Are historically accurate.
Sure, it references things that,
yes,
you know,
sure.
Auschwitz
exactly.
is a place.
Yeah.
It was liberated on a certain day.
Yeah.
Those things are mentioned in the text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what these characters were doing at that time, these characters have made up names, we don't know.
Right.
But again, there's something true about trying to figure out what those people, if they existed, could have been like. Mm-hmm. It's not historically accurate, but true in a more metaphorical way.
But is there not then a danger with this, a show like this then, because the Holocaust is not pleasant and it's something that a lot of people still have personal connections to, and if you're fictionalizing a story in a place like Auschwitz, is there not a chance that audiences could react really negatively to that, and to the point where they might think you're trivializing the experiences of those prisoners?
I would say that risk is definitely there, but when you actually see this play is actually about that risk.
Mm.
And so I think that by the time you get through it and follow the through line, and that's what's interesting about having the more contemporary framework as well as the historical framework, and looking at the tension between the two stories and the storytelling, it actually guides you to look at that question, as opposed to a film like The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, which is completely historically not useful at all and completely misleading and completely manipulating the audience and leaves so many viewers thinking something about the Holocaust and about what concentration camp existence could have been like. And it's, well, I don't, my guide when I visited Auschwitz, actually, this is his pet peeve, is movies like that, because it leaves, when he has students coming in to visit the camp, they're all waiting and looking for things from the movie. They think it's true, and there's nothing about that movie that actually accurately portrays what was going on there.
Except for Striped Pajamas, those were right over there.
And so, in fact, I think if you're talking about sort of the danger of trivializing or sensationalizing or whatever, I think that there's other artists out there that are committing that crime a lot more than this particular playwright.
Not to say that this is an exoneration.
No, it doesn't make us any necessarily better, but that's part of what the play's about.
Yeah, and if you're not risking that kind of negative reaction, then really, I mean, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's our job as artists to push the boundaries
a
bit. Yeah.
Sure.
But not in a you know, needlessly provocative way.
Right.
You know, not just for its own sake.
Right, so you're not sensationalizing.
Well, again, the play is about the potential to sensationalize something like this. So it's not, you know, it's not...
The play doesn't do it.
The play doesn't do it, but it does address...
But it's a danger for the character.
Yes, and it's directly addressed.
Right. So almost you're discussing or you're addressing what could be an issue that audiences have on stage.
Yes.
Absolutely. And that's what's been kind of fun for me as the director, because ultimately, it's on stage, so how am I going to make sure that the audience is following that question? And yes, it's in the text, and the actors are great, so they're telling the story, but what can I do to help shape it? And one of the things that I came at this play with, or one of the ideas I came with from the beginning, was that it is a play about how we look at things And when we look at them, are we driven to sensationalize or trivialize or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. So I've actually changed the seating configuration in the theater, which is really fun and not done all that much in Ottawa theater for various reasons. But Arts Court Theater is a flexible black box. So now we're doing the show in alley configuration, which means that there are audience members on two opposite sides with a stage in between. And so for me, it was really important that the experience of watching the play included the other onlooker.
Right.
So you could see someone else watching the story and know that you were being, not necessarily watched, but you could be seen mm-hmm. while you watched the story. Because it's a play about how we look at things. So I wanted the audience mm-hmm. to be inside that experience of looking and being mm-hmm. looked at, mm-hmm. as opposed to feeling like they were just looking at something on a screen like we do most of the time mm-hmm. With cinema and TV and everything, or even in a traditional theater staging where it's mm-hmm. sort of in that picture frame
right.
of the proscenium arch. I wanted to have to break that open and bring the audience into that experience.
Mm. Now, in terms of the staging then, how do you go from 2004 to Auschwitz? Like, is that not an extremely difficult thing to pull off in a stage production?
Oh, yes. You need a very talented director to be able to do that.
So we'll see if that happens. Well, what's fun about theater is the audience inherently wants to do away a little bit with reality and to believe things that we don't want. We don't have that impulse when we watch a movie. We want things to be perfectly accurate.
It
has to be complete. But in theater, there's space for the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And there's space for the audience to see things from a different angle and to try to put the pieces together and make their own picture. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why this play really needs to be a play. It would not translate necessarily to film. I mean, you could, to me, that would be less interesting than what it is on stage. So when we shift realities, I mean, all it really takes is a lighting shift and using a different area of the space, technically.
Mm-hmm.
What it takes is the audience to come with us.
Right.
You know, it takes your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And the actors are all doing their job to create the characters with as much detail and realism for themselves mm-hmm. to create a full character. And we have costumes that will represent their space. But in fact, our set is quite abstract. And leaves room for the for that transition between times.
Yeah. Now, and as an actor, how do you address this shifting reality, or I'll use reality, even though it's not real, this shifting reality on stage that the play is taking part in two different times,
mm-hmm.
and if you're set in one time, is it a challenge for you to sort of establish your character and maintain that energy when there's two different
realities
stories
going
yeah.
forward?
It's
you know what? It's the same challenge as any other play. So the two realities do not, as an actor, add an extra layer, because you're doing this thing that Bronwyn was talking about where you're creating a world. You're asking the audience to come with you. We're not actually in this room, in this woman's basement. We're on a stage. So once you take that for granted, then everything else just sort of comes along with it. You know, come on, don't look at the other actors when they're doing their scene in the 1940s.
Right.
Don't look at the audience and be like, what? Is this real? I don't know.
Yeah, in the end, actors have the most difficult and simplest job at the same time, which is you can't play everything.
Mm-hmm.
You can only play what you're doing.
You
want from the other actor. Why are you saying what you're saying? You play those actions and those intentions, and
mm-hmm.
you do understand the circumstances that your character is coming from, but you can't play all of them.
Right.
That's not really your job.
No.
You play what your character is doing.
An interesting challenge might be if you had to move from one timeline to the other and occupy two different characters in the same space, but that's not something. The worlds are very discrete, and they're treated more or less realistically.
Mm. More or less.
Getting back to sort of the subject matter too, though, as an actor, you're dealing with very heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a challenge for you to try to be? And maybe you can speak to this too, Bronwyn. When you're trying to entertain people with material that, frankly, is not entertaining.
Yeah.
In this sort of light, fun entertainment style.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you address that? Or is it really all about just finding the character?
From you know, from an acting perspective, as a entering into a space as a professional, yes, you want to find your character, you want to do the work. It's not up to you to say something is entertaining or fun or sexy, but it's true what you're saying, that when you're trying to sell the show to people, you're saying, you know, it's a fun, sexy Holocaust comedy. It doesn't sound very good.
But our playwright was very clever, because it does actually have a lot of sexy comedy moments in it. And she's done that in a very clever and probably calculated way to make it so that it's not just this Holocaust play. That's the last thing I think that Dara wanted when she was writing this play, was for it to end up feeling bogged down by the history and the weight and all that stuff. So she has included these characters and these interactions with them that are quite fun. And that's actually part of Daniel's job is, you know, he's not to say he's the comic relief in the play, but...
But he is.
He probably has the most jokes.
Yes, exactly. That's very important. And so, yeah, and when you're working, also, you know, when we're working on the play, as all of us, we talk about this very heavy stuff a lot. And so it's important then, even in the development environment, to keep things light, to take breaks for jokes every once in a while, and, you know, just keep our hearts above a certain level.
That was, I think, the most challenging time was more in the preparation period for me when I did my research trip, and then trying to sort of hold that information and bring it back and share that experience with the actors. And we had to learn about Auschwitz. We had to take some time, because even if the play's not about that, we're there. So we have to understand that world. So that was the hardest in terms of what you're talking about holding all that negative energy and information. But now that it's more, we're moving into the story and what's going on for the characters, that has receded into the background, I think, for most of us. It's still part of the process, and it was an important part of it, but we don't have to feel so weighted down by it.
The interesting question, though, is do we ever have to feel, I mean, I don't know what you think about this, but if we're theater makers and we're just, you know, actors and we're coming in to do something, is it beneficial for us as part of the process to really feel the weight of the thing that we're talking about?
Well, if you're going to play Macbeth, I don't think you should go murder someone first, right? You know, like, you don't have to have killed someone to understand what it feels like to be a murderer, because that's completely inappropriate. You can't do that. So we have to...
But would a murderer have a better take on the character?
It's possible. We were just talking about, on the way here, how I've actually done theater in a prison. So anyway, I could ask the guys there. So with some plays, you know that there are boundaries you can't cross. There's things you can't ever understand. But for me, maybe it's just the kind of personality I have. I want to have a personal connection to what I'm doing as a director or as an actor as much as possible. So it's part of my process in telling the story. But I wouldn't say that it's necessary for every show, because it's impossible for some shows, or necessary for every actor, because if you're good at your craft, then you know whatever you need to do to get you into the right place.
Maybe. I don't know. It's a tough one. To your point, though, it is very difficult for people who are like, you know, what should we do tonight? Let's go see a play about the Holocaust. That sounds like fun. It's, you know, it might be a hard thing to convince people to do. But
you should come see our play.
Yeah, this play
fun.
Is very, very unique in that way. I think it's actually a lot of fun.
Well, I know for me, like, I don't watch a lot of movies, or frankly, I don't watch a lot of TV, but when I'm sitting down at the end of the day trying to figure out, I have an hour, I should watch something.
You want to decompress.
It's going to be a comedy.
Yes.
More often than not. Yeah. Something I don't really have to think about.
Yeah.
I can just watch it. And I know even, like, I think the cast and crew of Schindler's List, when they were making the movie, they were so depressed making the movie that they had tapes of Seinfeld brought in.
For sure.
And every night they would just sit around and watch Seinfeld at the end of the day just to sort of release from this thing.
Perfect.
And so I could see how that, even if your character is set in 2004, just the context of what is being discussed.
No, you're right. That was an issue. We got sort of heavy during the process. And, you know, we did have to have those moments where we decompress and we'd go around the table and everyone would tell a joke.
Right.
We did that a few times. And then you get back to work. And it's up to you to make sure that you can go as far as you can into the darkness without having your heart completely broken and becoming unable to work. Mm. Because at the end, you are trying to work. You're trying to tell a story. And it's not going to serve the story.
Right. And that's the thing, is we are storytellers. We're not doing this for us. Mm-hmm. We're not yeah. doing this to put ourselves through this wrenching his emotional experience every time. No. Certainly not. And we're not just doing it to make ourselves laugh either. No. We're doing it for you. Mm. We're storytellers, and that's such a human impulse to tell stories and to listen to them or watch them. Mm-hmm. So I think it's. I mean, this is why I'm an artist, right? This is. It just feels like it's my. What I'm built to do is mm-hmm. to bring up ideas and questions and provoke, hopefully, people think and feel things, but not, for me, not in an academic way mm. and not just in a discussion. I do it through telling a story.
Mm. And this is such a great story also.
Yeah, this is a good one.
The end, you know, this show has one of the best endings of any play I have ever read in my entire life. It's one of my favorites.
I agree. A lot of times you feel like the playwright has sort of written themselves into a corner and mm. has to just sort of end it, and you can feel that in movies and everything too.
But in mm. this one, it is all leading up to this final scene, and it's just, every time I watch it, I love it. I can.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So there's a big payoff.
There's a huge payoff at the end.
And it's interesting, too, because the way it's written and the way I've staged it, too, it's quite small in terms of what's technically happening. It's a very simple scene. It's not like a big gunshot,
spectacle.
It's not, with a big song and dance. Or, it's very small and intimate, just between these characters and us as the audience and ourselves. It's very simple. Mm. But yes, absolutely. I think the payoff is really.
This is everything I love it.
I want to go back to something you said, Bron, when you said there are certain lines you can't cross. I want to question as to whether or not that's true. Are there things that maybe you aren't willing to do, or do you believe there's a general rule that there are certain lines, certain things that you can't do in a production?
Artistically, you mean?
Yeah.
There's lines you shouldn't cross.
Oh, right. Well, I think that. I guess I was speaking more about in terms of your preparation to try to understand an experience. You can't.
Shouldn't murder someone.
You shouldn't murder someone or rape someone or, you know, if something's illegal, you probably don't want to do it and say, oh, I was just doing my actor homework or my director homework. But in terms of what you can actually put on stage and what you can do in a production that's not concerned with the law, it really. It's all about serving the story. And in terms of questions of things like nudity on stage or foul language or whatever those things are, or having actors with their back to the audience, all these things that are conventionally not supposed to be done, it depends on the story.
Okay.
I think that if the thing that you're doing that breaks the rules makes the audience go, oh, hey, they broke the rules, instead of, oh, this is an amazing story, then you did it just to break the rules. And and to me, why would you do that?
Okay.
You know, so when I have staged plays that there were opportunities for nudity, for example, I generally as a director, well, not generally, in the past as a director, I've always chosen not to have full nudity. Because to me, it makes the audience go, I'm looking at a naked person, instead of I'm watching a story.
Right.
Whereas taking off most of the clothes and still having underwear on, we go, oh, okay, they're taking off their clothes. Mm. What's going on? What's going to happen next?
Right.
So for me, that's usually the choice I make as a director. But there may be a play that I do one day where you really have to see the actor naked. And then you just figure out how to present it in a way where we can get the audience beyond the, oh, I'm looking at a naked person response, and back into I'm following the story.
Mm.
And in that case, that's a big challenge for a director, but if the story really demands it, you have to find a way.
Okay, because I was almost thinking sort of something like The Producers, that it to me it works. The Springtime for Hitler works because you shouldn't do that.
Yes,
absolutely.
Exactly.
And this play also has, I don't want to give it away because it's a spoiler, but it has a moment that for sure. Or not even just one, but there are certain things that are...
A Springtime for Hitler moment,
and there's certain bits of text that are like, whoa, can you really be saying that?
Yeah.
But, like Springtime for Hitler, it's part of the story. It's part of, and as long as you get through the full story to the end, you realize why it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and maybe Springtime for Hitler, you figure out why it's there without getting to the end.
Right.
Yeah.
They tell you why. But it's still serving the story.
Okay. right.
Which, yeah, for us as storytellers is just more important than anything else.
Might be fun to, because within the producers, they do Springtime for Hitler in the context of Something You Shouldn't Do. Yes. But does anyone have the balls to actually just do Springtime for Hitler and then assume that the conversation that takes place around that show in the real world will be the context that's a part of that show? So they only do the provocative act without providing the safety net of, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. This is bad. Right.
That's interesting you bring it up. The last time I worked with Dara, and the first time I worked with her, we created a piece that was just a 15-minute piece. And it was called Greek Culture. And it dealt with sort of sexual violence and social media. And there was a scene that was basically a date rape scene.
Okay.
And I felt very uncomfortable as a director. I was just really, really nervous about not creating space then to talk about what I had shown the audience. And I was really afraid, like, will they get it that what I'm actually doing is commenting on that? And of course they did. The audience did get it. And it was only a 15-minute piece, so all I did was make them all feel horrible for 15 minutes while they watched it, and then watch them walk away, and just hope that they got it and had the right experience. And in the end, I was able to talk to some people who saw it and realize that, yes, you need to trust that the audience can put it together and not think that you're saying date rape is a good thing to do. clearly, that's not what the play is about. But it was very hard for me as a director to not also create some kind of space around the story that made it a little bit safer, to create something that was really
a little dangerous
and a little bit wrong and made you feel really dirty watching it.
Right. So without explicitly saying this is wrong,
yeah,
we're not supporting this. That's the point of the show. Yeah. Good night.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Like, you're leaving that unsaid, and they are making the connection.
Exactly. And it was really fun too. That particular piece, fun. Risky, I guess, is the word, because it was performed site specifically, so not in a theater.
Okay.
It was performed in a loading dock space, actually also at Arts Court, and the audience was brought in as if they were sort of another character in the story. They were being brought to watch something in the loading dock, and I wanted the audience to have the feeling of, oh my God, should I stop this? This is wrong. I wanted them to have to go with that internal struggle of, this shouldn't be happening. And because it was not in a theater, and you were being talked to and brought in by one of the characters as if you were supposed to be there, it made it implicate the audience in the experience in a way, which I was really interested in playing with. But it also made me really nervous as an artist. Like, what are people going to think of me? Yeah. You know, what are they going to think of the play? Will they get it?
Right. Yeah. And I guess that leads into a discussion of the audience. I mean, you talked about how you have the theater set up so that the audience is sort of looking at each other, which adds another dynamic. But how conscious are you, apart from just staging, of the audience in a show? And whether it be the technical things, trying to figure out where you might have to hold for an audience reaction, whether it be a laugh or otherwise, or thinking about, is the audience going to get this? Do we have to be more explicit here? Can we be more implicit here? I mean, and trying to find that balance. I mean, how conscious are you of the audience in putting something together, or as an actor?
Yeah, I was going to say, Daniel, why don't you go first?
Well, very much you learn the rhythms of the audience on both a night-by-night basis, so every audience is going to be different. Sometimes they're going to be very laughy, and so you know at certain points in the show you're going to get a laugh, you're going to have to hold there. But also, in a general sense, you're not going to know about the real rhythms of the play until you get an audience in there. Mm-hmm. So you go through the preparation, you have an idea in your mind of where things are going to land and how they're going to roll, and then you find out how they actually land and how they actually roll, and you make little accommodations on each and every night, and you sort of adjust your work slightly for it. So you're aware of them. You try to keep that awareness below a certain threshold so it doesn't affect overall what you've been preparing to do and what you've been doing. And beyond that, everything you're doing is for the audience and with the monolithic audience in mind. All the preparation you've been doing, the rehearsing, everything is with the idea of, you know, somebody is watching this and they're completing it. And until they're in there, you haven't been completing your work. You've been doing, you know, half of a job. It's when they get in there that the story finally closes and is real. In terms of how much can you risk not explaining to them or spoon feeding them, I think that's when the really exciting thing is when you risk losing a certain portion of the audience. You know, earlier you were talking about, are you going to get people in to see the show who are worried that you're trivializing the Holocaust? And I think you know, in any audience, there's going to be people who either don't get it, or they fall short, or they interpret it in a way that you didn't necessarily intend. And that can be very exciting, and it opens up the discussion. And I think you just, you try to aim it at a certain percentage that you know might be in line with what you're thinking, and then you let everyone else just sort of fly on their own. And that's a decision that's made, I think, by each director. And I think in this case, you've had an idea in mind that you want to take the audience together with us on this journey completely, and I think that's exactly what we've done.
Yeah, it's as you say, it's my job. I have to consider the audience.
Yeah.
The actors do it generally in a more instinctive way, and again, once the audience has actually arrived, they're responding sort of organically to what that energy that they feel. But my job is from day one to consider the place of the audience in the storytelling and try to be the advocate for the audience. And when it's as simple as, I can't hear this,
right.
or I can't see this, or this moment is too fast for me to process it. Mm. And then I can give those very clear directions to the actors and explain what it is that I need from them to make a moment more clear. But also for the experience of giving the audience the space to connect the dots and for me to try to figure out how much do we need to give them? And this is interesting, too, with Corpus, because it's the world premiere, and we have Dara still involved with the production, is also there are certain bits of the text that we're still able to explore. And she's changed a few lines and cut some sections and added a few things, because once you start to play with it with actors doing the whole thing, you realize, oh, wait, I don't need to tell the audience this because the actors are already going to show it. Or if we tell them and show them this, that'll derail their understanding of this whole storyline and make them not be able to come along with us in that way. So, oh, wait, we have to change the way that's staged, or we have to cut that section, or we have to fiddle with it a little bit. So it's been really great having Dara involved because she's able to make some changes as well. Not that I've asked her to change much of anything. In fact, she's the one who's realizing when she wants to change things more than I am. But as a director, I have the ability for once to look at a moment and go, I'm not sure if this moment makes sense to me. And instead of having to just dig deeper and make sense of force us all to make sense of it, we can also look at the moment and talk to Dara and see if there's another way, another way to tell the story in that moment.
Is a play like this, though, relying on a certain type of audience member or a certain type of audience, people who are familiar with the story of the Holocaust to a certain degree?
No. I don't think so. And in fact, there's always the question of playing to sort of the highest common denominator or the lowest. I strive in my work to elevate the audience to a higher common denominator and to trust that they will come along and they'll get what they get. They may not get everything, but I would never want to play only to an elite audience that had to know something, or on the other hand, play down to an audience and tell them everything.
Yeah.
I think you want to find that place where you can bring them along for the journey, but allow them their own space to connect the dots. And no, they certainly don't need to know anything about this time in history to follow the story.
Yeah.
Do you see this as educating people in any form, then?
Educating?
Yeah, if you don't need a background in the Holocaust.
Or genocide in general.
Is this a way for people to become familiar with it?
It's an interesting question, but why? Is that something that you think people would want, or you think that's something that would make it more or less worthwhile, or just...
I'm just curious in how you conceive it, because to me, if you're going to say that no background needed, right?
Background needed to come to the play and really enjoy it and get something out of it.
Yeah. Then, at some point, because you're discussing this, you have to explain kind of what happened. You can't... If I have no idea what the Holocaust is, I'm an alien, and I come to see the show. If I don't know what the Holocaust is, if you don't say what it is and sort of lay it out to a certain degree and explain kind of what happened, then are you not doing a disservice?
Well, there's exposition and then there's education, right? There's context that's given. The characters certainly, I think.
Yeah, they talk about certain things and they
Explaining is different than teaching.
Okay.
I think more worthwhile than educating or saying something would be to put that spark of inspiration for someone to become very interested themselves. A bit more of an inception idea, if you will, where they might become interested to do more follow-up work, because there's a real limit to what you can do. As Bronwyn is saying, exposition versus education. Do you want to go to something that is a lecture, you know, where you do learn a lot of things, but it's less of a storytelling, or do you want to see a story where you might learn some things? It's a balance.
Right.
And so where you lean more towards story with some education, hopefully what you've done is you've inspired them to learn more themselves.
Absolutely, and it's not, I mean, again, it depends on how you define education. Is learning something, learning the dates and the facts and the number of deaths, or is learning something about being able to interrogate an idea and have a discussion and be provoked to think about something? And hopefully that's what the play does, is it's a jumping off point for further investigation or discussion or understanding. Whether you learn about the Holocaust or not, maybe you learn about yourself or about how you see things or about how you can talk about something.
I would like to amend something that I said before, though, where I said no. I mean, when you go and see anything, there's an assumption of a certain amount of prior knowledge for any play that you see. So, for example, Death of a Salesman, you know what a salesman is.
Right.
You know about someone who goes door-to-door and things
like
that. And so you have some contextual knowledge. And I think for this play, knowing that there were, you know, death camps in Europe during World War II and that something really, really bad happened there, you know, I'm hesitant to say that it would heighten your appreciation of the play, because I really do think that if you come in knowing nothing, you're going to see this story and you're going to be taken on the journey and get a lot out of it. But I think someone who has the idea, they know, they've heard the word Auschwitz before in their life, or they know about the Holocaust.
And they know the definition of the word genocide.
They know of genocides. They know a genocide happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it might give them some more context. But again, is it necessary? No. Do we assume that a certain percentage of the audience has it? I would say that we do.
Right.
Well, it's not a niche thing.
No, it's pretty That's general
right. yeah.
knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you were doing a play on, say, I'll just pick something from my own research because I can pick on my own research, the 1937 World Concert that the CBC broadcast.
Yeah.
You might have to explain what that was.
You should.
Yeah.
You should.
Yes, but I think when a story is well told, you find a way to give that context without having to, again, give a lecture about it.
Right.
And then even though I go in not knowing anything about that, I might be completely able to follow a story and find it completely fascinating. If the story is well told, the universal, again, is in the details. So trust that the audience can handle some details. Just throw them at them.
Yeah. You'll come out feeling more connected to it than anything else.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen countless movies about historical things or places where you didn't know anything about it going in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you had to, like, read a primer first, or can you just watch the, you know?
Yeah, right, yeah. No, it's, yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, sometimes you do want to read a primer even after you've seen something. You would want to read a primer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you did, I mean, I'm sure you're thinking now of writing a play about the 1937 CDC
concert. Oh, sure, yeah.
I think it's going to be great. Keep us posted. It's going to be a good play.
Yeah, it'd be full of action. One guy sitting behind a microphone.
Hot for damn.
2 hours.
Wow.
Well, but
sounds
if it's
great.
A concert, it great. Could be a musical, right?
Yes, because there's
music at concerts.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Some of that old 30s jazz music into a theater musical.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, the idea needs some development, but, you know, we're working something.
But again, what's the question here? What's it about?
Yeah. I've intentionally left this because this is something I find really interesting. It's this notion of memory and how we remember stuff and how people's versions are different. If there's a car accident, the person in one car has their story, the person in the other car has their story, and usually the truth is somewhere in the middle of those two things. And this play is about, in part, about addressing how we remember. And it's in the context of the Holocaust, but that's a universal theme. And I'm curious as to how you address this issue in a way that is provocative, or in a way that will force the audience to reconsider the way maybe they think about things.
That's exactly what the play addresses, is the memory and sometimes the discrepancy with the way that you remember things, or the way you think you knew things. You know, there's all these studies now that say that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, that people's memories in generally are unreliable, that they're colored by emotion. And so this play talks about how something, how you can study something or remember something that is so colored by emotion, like a genocide or something that happened to you, that how could you ever hope to remember it reliably, and yet you strive to do so, and there's ways around it, and there's ways of doing it. How this play provocatively addresses those issues, I think, is just by, you know, showing it in a deeply personal and affecting way to someone that you might identify with.
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer, because I think that it's, again, we're storytellers, so we want to honor our story and not give away too much. But
that is very much a core to the story.
That is the core of the story. And technically, what we get to see is we do get to see scenes that are played out in a way where the story is sort of revealed, and then your understanding of it kind of shifts, as opposed to something that's a bit more linear narrative. If the whole play just took place in 1944 and was not a memory play at all, it would be completely different. And so what's really fun, and I think what is really theatrical about the play, is seeing the scene and then seeing the next thing that kind of picks up where it left off, but not really, and maybe something's a little different. It's it allows you to have a little bit of that wiggle room of, wait, whose perspective am I looking at this from? Who's telling the story here? And that's what's really fun, I think, about
that. So, you know, you're challenging the traditional notions of what this is, right? That's part of what it is. Like, I think for something like the Holocaust, there has developed a universality of looking at it, or a universal way of looking at it. And what happens is a challenging of that narrative to a certain degree. And to me, that's really interesting, because, you know, that's how memory works, is that it's not a static thing. It's constantly changing. And the way we remember slavery in 2014 is different from the way people remembered slavery in 1920. And the way that people remember a Holocaust in, you know, 2050 is going to be different from how we remember the Holocaust today.
Absolutely.
And it's going to constantly change. So the fact that you're addressing this on stage, one, strikes me as being extremely difficult. And two, that's, to me, is what makes this super appealing as a story, that you can weave all these levels together of the Holocaust, the negative emotions of the Holocaust, with this really interesting plot of memory and the social construction of memory.
To me that's
really fascinating to me, and I think that's really cool.
And I think yes, it's difficult. Luckily the playwright did like the first hard job, which was coming up with the story. And it's we have to figure out delicately how to stage it, but really, as Daniel said earlier, we can't even do it without you, without the audience, without you completing the circle, because you need to have the experience of finding your way through the story and then be able to reflect on it. We can't do it for you, in fact. So yes, it's challenging, but it's something that we do in partnership with the audience.
Right. It is something that's very dangerous to do with the Holocaust as well, to do any sort of, you know, what you're saying about remembering things differently, revisiting, revisioning, because everybody is so quick to accuse someone of, you know, denial or Holocaust revisionism or something like that, which is a horrible crime anywhere in the world these days. I don't think that's anything that happens in this show, but it is an interesting thing to address in a way that is delicate, and with a playwright who you can trust doing it and handling those sort of difficult issues.
No, you're right, because there are people who I know who do Holocaust studies who, you know, write certain things in an academic sense and then are accused of being of anti-Semitic.
And it's so fraught with that kind of danger, when really what they're doing is they're trying to look at evidence, they're trying to look at different interpretations of evidence, and it's not a pointed political thing, but it's still, it's very, very personal.
It is.
Extremely personal.
These things you can't get away from the personal for some people, and it's.
But maybe in 2050 you will be able to.
Maybe.
You know? Let's end with this, because I thought it was so funny when I read it on the website. The main female character is a scholar, and one of the things that the website says is she's confronted with this notion of scholarly fame,
Yeah.
What is that?
That's when you publish your thesis.
Did you make
that
up?
You're a rock star.
No. Did you invent that? Sir, that's not a thing.
That's
is
a
it?
Thing. That's a thing. Scholarly fame. Well, you know, it's whatever it is. It's very insular. You can be very, very famous as a scholar amongst other scholars.
Yeah.
Right. In your field.
But I think the idea, and because this. Yeah, because it's theatrical, so we're pushing the boundaries of reality a little bit, is that if your scholarly work is that good, it could also be a trade book, right?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
You could burst out of just academic and, exactly. and people are going to be buying this in bookstores.
Yeah, Bertrand
yeah.
Russell. There's a guy with
so
a
there you go,
fame.
That's scholarly fame.
People buy his book, put it on
I really, I know, I thought that was so funny. and what kind of experience... I guess we'll end on this. What kind of experience do the two of you have sort of in academic forms? Because you're addressing these very heady issues,
mm-hmm.
and you can't do that being completely unaware of...
The way academia works
yeah.
in general.
And,
yeah.
and so just what sort of familiarity do you have with academics?
I was raised by professors.
Okay.
There were grad students in my house my whole life. Uh-huh. Like, there were always mm-hmm. grad students around. And then I became one, and, you know, that was cool.
Yes.
No, I did my MFA here at Ottawa U.
Okay.
And even though my MFA was a... practical degree and focused on learning to direct plays, there was still a lot of research that I had to do. I wrote a massive thesis paper as well as directing a thesis production. So
okay.
I feel like I know the academic world.
Mm, yes.
I'm pretty comfortable with it between my family experience and my
sure.
personal experience. What's interesting is the two characters who are really going through that, Sasha Cole, who plays Megan, and John Konskin, who plays her professor Homer, neither of them are academic-y people. So
okay.
we had
mm-hmm.
to really, you know, explain certain things to
mm-hmm.
them. And
so they would get it, yeah.
But anyone can understand ambition.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
it doesn't matter if you understand it in the scholarly sense.
Mm-hmm.
And once we checked what all the references were so that they knew when we reference Foucault, what's that about,
yeah.
then you can understand that.
Yeah.
But what's more interesting, especially in their... They have a particular scene that has a lot of academic text in it, but it's not about that at all. It's about the relationship between the student and the professor and this thesis and what's happened because of her writing of the thesis, what's happened between them as people.
Right.
And not about the ideas.
Yeah.
And yet they're academic people, so they speak in these, or at least the characters, I don't know if academics always do this, my parents do a bit, they speak in big concepts, but you can't really stage that. You have to stage characters
yeah.
interacting, humans, you know, acting.
And I've dated a lot of grad students.
Okay.
So I know what a wretched swamp that can
yeah.
be as well. Just the worst thing in the world. Yeah.
We're fun people.
Super fun.
We're fun people.
Until it's thesis time.
Yeah. Yes, and then we become not fun people.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Well, we're still fun, but you'll never see us.
That's
yeah,
all.
You're just we're having fun with your laptop.
Yeah,
that's
we
good.
Just we just hang out on our own.
With
and
your,
but
with
and,
your library books.
And could you... But, you know, at the same time then, if the advisor is there, how great would it be if in real life you could go through a whole thesis process in 2 hours.
Oh,
that would be great.
Are you kidding me?
It'd
make
yeah.
the world a better
Ooh,
place.
Totally.
That'd be delightful. So we set at the start, but let's go through it again. The play is Corpus at the Arts Court Theater. Opening night is Friday the 2nd.
That's right.
And you're running through the 10th.
That's right.
Showtimes at 7?
In the evenings at 8 o'clock.
Eight
we have
o'clock.
A couple matinee performances at 2 o'clock. On Saturday the 3rd and the 10th, and also on Wednesday the 7th, which is a student and senior special mm-hmm. matinee. So any students out there, check it out. And tickets are available on the Arts Court website, which is artscourt.ca. You can also find more information about the show in general on my website, so counterpointplayers.com. We're still fundraising for this show.
Oh, yes, that's right. There's an Indiegogo campaign that
it's
is active.
Yeah, it's a very... It's, as I told you on the way off the elevator, this is my first time directing and producing a
mm-hmm.
show this big, and we're very fortunate with some of our grant applications. We have received some funding, but grants and ticket sales actually don't make shows.
No.
Mm-hmm. They make part of a show.
Right.
So we are doing some fundraising too
okay.
to help with that. So you can find us on Indiegogo if you... use the Indiegogo search tools for a theater in Ottawa. You'll find it. It's Counterpoint Players. It's Corpus. Find it through there.
Terrific. And is there any way, Daniel, that people can sort of find, if they want to know more about you as an actor, find out about your...
Yes, they should definitely Google me, Daniel Sadovoy. They'll find all kinds of interesting stuff, find some really just exciting articles about things and mediocre reviews of fantastic work that I've done in the past.
You could also probably like follow you on Twitter or something.
Oh yeah, follow me on Twitter at Daniel Sadaboy.
There you go.
Yeah, and you can follow us at Counterpoint Players, is spelled counter PT, so point is abbreviated, and then players is PLYERS. That's annoying to say out loud.
That is annoying. We gotta change that.
Well, if you Google Counterpoint Players Twitter,
you'll find it.
You'll find it.
Yeah, or Bronwyn Steinberg.
Mm-hmm. Right, and if you come, and or if you go to the website, I know you have it there too, so you can find it. So follow them on Twitter, and if you're in Ottawa, go see the show. And I believe the show is scheduled to be to run in the fall in Montreal.
That's right. The play is being staged again, but it's not our production, so it's going to be staged with a different director, different actors. So it'll be very interesting. I'm definitely planning on heading to Montreal to see it, because I'm very curious about seeing another director's vision. But yeah, Dara started writing the play about 10 years ago, and then suddenly we have two productions happening in the same year.
Yeah,
so.
That's good.
It won the 2007 Calgary Peace Play Prize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess it was just read on stage, or was that just the text?
Yeah, so it was the script itself that won the prize, and that was a playwriting competition.
Yep.
And I believe for that one, yes, there was a workshop or a reading of it. But this is, our production is the first time it's fully staged with a full rehearsal process.
It has been workshopped. It's won several awards in different places. It's, you know.
Yeah, but it's, people are always asking me, how is, can it be a world premiere and also award-winning?
Yeah.
But the script itself is
award-winning 7 years ago. One thing if it won an award this year, but but I guess that just speaks to how difficult it is to get some things produced.
Yeah, that's true.
And the process, and it just takes a long time.
Absolutely,
So if you're in the National Capital Region, or even if you're outside the National Capital Region.
Yeah, come on down.
Come into the National Capital Region. Check it out at Arts Court. And Arts Court is a fun building if you've never been there. It's a fun place to go see a show. And the theater is not huge. Like, there's a connection there.
Oh, yeah.
Very absolutely. Intimate, very and especially intimate. The way that it's staged. You're really a part of the story when you see the show.
So that is Daniel Sadaboy and Bronwyn Steinberg. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.